Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Radio.com. Radio.com.
This evening, we have a full day of coverage from the hockey arena as Hockman and Crowder were live asking if pretzel places be busy. That was the topic from earlier on in the day, of course, in the build-up to the Florida Panthers and the Carolina Hurricanes. 7 p.m. is the puck drop this evening. If you want to get to the arena, there is still plenty of time to do so. It is a gorgeous evening for hockey, so do come on over to the BB&T Center and check out the Panthers and the Carolina Hurricanes. A big one in the specter of the NHL standings. Florida Panthers currently 9 points out of the final playoff spot, but Carolina, one of those teams in the way. Columbus right now holding the final playoff spot on 69 points. Carolina just that spot below at 68. So Florida has to jump Philadelphia, Buffalo, and Carolina in order to get to Columbus. So tonight will certainly be a massive game, as every game will be for Florida as they go down the stretch of the season. We'll be joined at the end of the hour by Doug Plagans and Billy Lindsay, who will be on the call and look ahead to this one this evening. And I'm told that Doug Plagans had some terrific food takes from earlier on in the day on the Hockman and Crowder show, so we'll definitely get his thoughts on certainly the food here that is a tremendous, and just a food in general. I'm told that Doug Plagans is a connoisseur, so we'll get to that later on in the program. And we got plenty of NBA to discuss here, and I'm no doubt looking forward to the final stretch. People call it the second half. It's more like the final third of the NBA season that the All-Star Game divides the year into. And the Heat are back in action tonight, taking on the Philadelphia 76ers. And I'm interested to see a few things here. First is the personnel issue that the Miami Heat have. So Derrick Jones Jr. and Goran Dragic are not going to be ready for tonight, as Biff told you in the update. But Goran Dragic and Derrick Jones Jr. are expected back at some point. And this brings up a number of questions. Derrick Jones Jr., when he was healthy, was climbing in his role in the rotation, was coming off the bench and playing a decent-sized role in the rotation for the Miami Heat. And then he goes out, and that allows other players to have their opportunity at minutes. And in some respects, the Heat's trade before the deadline, beyond the fact that, you know, you're getting off a little bit of salary, you trade Wayne Ellington's expiring, you get about as close as you can to going underneath the luxury tax, and also being able to get a little bit more cap space for next year by waiving Ryan Anderson. It also, by trading for a player that you have no intentions on playing, I thought that from the beginning, and that's how it's proven to be. Ryan Anderson has played 2 minutes in 4 games since coming to the Miami Heat. He's not going to be a figure in the rotation. So you take him out. You basically have taken 2 guys out, one in Tyler Johnson, who was playing a regular role and at times starting, and Wayne Ellington, the other, who was disappointed to not be playing, and replacing them with a guy in Ryan Anderson who probably comes in expecting that he's not going to play for 2 months and he's going to get waived at the end of it. So in some respects, you've cleared a little bit of a glut of players that were clogging up the Heat's rotation. And that, for me, is a smart decision. I think the Heat have a fair amount of addition by subtraction to do. The move for them to make is a 3-for-1 trade. And frankly, a 3-for-1 trade is what this team was built around, right? That we're going to have 3 guys, or, you know, 7 guys, really, at somewhere between $8 million and $14 million worth of salary, and we can combine them into any trade to trade for a guy who makes 30. That 3-for-1 is going to be attractive to them because they're getting solid players, and it's going to be attractive to us because we get the one star that we need. And that's basically the model of the team. And what's basically happened is that no team really wants those $10 million players, or at least the ones that the Heat don't want to get rid of are the players that other teams would want, and frankly, the players that they'd be okay with parting with, nobody wants. And maybe they'll want them when they're expiring, but for now, they are some of the least desirable trade pieces in the entire league. And so you basically have this glut of players, And then, on top of that, you are adding to the glut of players by developing Rodney Magruder into a rotation-caliber piece, by developing Derek Jones Jr. as one. Who knows if Duncan Robinson could be next, or the guy that they signed for, you know, to a full team roster who played as part of, you know, in the G League. I forget his name, but maybe that's the next guy that the Heat are developing, that they have now become a team that routinely, through the G League, through the draft, is developing rotation-caliber players for their team, which, for the 10,000th time, is why you don't pay James Johnson 4 years and, you know, $15 million in the final year of that contract. And so, in some respects, you've gotten rid of a glut, right? You've basically went two for nothing in a trade, right? And yet, when Goran Dragic and Derek Jones Jr. are healthy, you now have 11 rotation-caliber players. And it's just insane to me. I mean, you know, obviously, Rodney Magruder is probably the first that's going to go back to being a DNP coach's decision, but then you're down to 10. And is it basically, you know, who's the guy that's maybe dealing with a little bit of injury? That guy gets a night off. But here are your 11 when Goran Dragic and Derek Jones Jr. are ready to go. You have a starting lineup in the Dallas game was Richardson, Waiters, Winslow, Olynyk, and Whiteside. And coming off the bench was James Johnson, Rodney Magruder, Bam Adebayo, Dwayne Wade. And then you throw in Derek Jones Jr. and Goran Dragic. So my guess is that Goran Dragic gets sort of a majority of Rodney Magruder's minutes, which was 25 minutes. Maybe you shave a bit off of Waiters, shave a bit off of Richardson, and that's your 29 to 31 minutes and Goran Dragic is going to play. But where do you get the 15 to 20 minutes for Derek Jones Jr., and are you going to be playing an 11th player? And the fact that the Heat traded two guys for no one, and they still have a problem with too many guys, is just, it's a fascinating problem. And frankly, I think from a coaching standpoint, it's got to be so hard for Eric Spoelstra, because not only do you have 11 guys, not only do you really not know how to figure out the best way to employ 9 of them, or even all 11 of them if you wanted to, which you really don't. As you get down the stretch run of the year, you're playing less guys, not more, and really it's going to depend on injuries for some guys to play. But on top of that, because these guys aren't the most talented players in the NBA, you don't really know what you're getting from night to night. So on top of having to figure out the right 9 guys, you're trying to figure out who on a given night is playing well, and you might not figure that out until halftime, and then might it be too late. Like, it's just so much to be trying to figure out. When you look at, I mean, you know, Oklahoma City has their defined starting lineup. Indiana has their defined starting lineup, and they just go with it. The Heat don't have that at all. I mean, I'll look it up right now, which lineup for them has played the most minutes together, and it's going to feel, you know, much lower than other teams in the NBA, and how much their guys are able to develop a continuity, develop a rotation that makes sense. The Heat just don't have it. And I think it just makes for, particularly in the world of professional athletes that love to know their roles. So over the course of the year, they're just are not very many players that are playing together as a five-man unit. So there's actually only one lineup in the NBA, in the Heat's roster, that has played more than 100 minutes together. And that is the lineup of James Johnson, Hassan Whiteside, Rodney Magruder, Justice Winslow, and Josh Richardson. That was among the earlier starting lineups on the year. It was actually one of the more reviled starting lineups for the Heat. They were a negative 10 in 163 minutes together. No other lineup for the Heat has played more than 100 minutes together. And it's just so damn hard to develop continuity that way and really figure out how to play. And you're only making this problem worse by reintroducing Dragic, by reintroducing Derek Jones Jr. And I just don't know going down the stretch what's going to happen there. And then obviously, you know, with Dragic coming back, there is also the issue of Justice Winslow having his role reduced, which I've kind of vacillated on this subject. I, going into the year, had kind of written off Justice Winslow as a player that can be certainly a build-around piece, but even like a starter. Like, I don't know if he was a starting caliber player, because I didn't trust his three-point shot, and you don't trust his ability around the rim. And as an offensive player, what more could you have, right? I mean, in this NBA, in the Daryl Morey NBA, it's layups and threes. And so if you are not good, but not only bad, but flagrantly bad at both of those things, it's going to be hard to be a viable offensive player. And I just grown frustrated. And frankly, I just didn't see the path for a guy, even age is one thing, But for me, years experience, number of games is another. He had played 200 NBA games, and he had played for 3 years with the Miami Heat and hadn't shown even a glimpse of being able to be good at any of those things. And yet, he's really emerged. The playmaking role, the ball-handling role has suited him. And really, since Goran Dragic went out and he really started to solidify himself, it's 2 months' worth of games, almost, that we're talking about. So it's early December. It's more than 2 months' worth of games that we're talking about. He has been, by far, the Heat's most winning player. If you look at the net rating numbers, difference between on the court and off the court, the Heat are plus 11 with Justice Winslow over a two-month period, a longer than two-month period, and Justice Winslow has been a key part of what the Miami Heat do, and playmaking and demonstrating all of the skills that you thought you saw in college, no doubt a far more confident three-point shooter, and stepping into it and firing it with a level of confidence you just hadn't seen from him. And so how much does that change when you introduce Goran Dragic, and now you have, on top of Dwayne Wade and Deion Waiters, players who like the ball in their hands, a player who fancies himself a point guard who is going to want to bring the ball off the floor and isn't necessarily the most comfortable off-ball player, though he can be in Dragic. How much of that gets taken away by virtue of Goran Dragic returning at the point at which he does? That's not going to be tonight, but it's going to happen at some point. And does Justice Winslow kind of fall back into a smaller role, and does he start to look like the player that I was saying at the beginning was, for me, a lost hope of being even a starting caliber player? And so do you take away what you've seen positively out of this player by taking him out? And if that does happen, do you then basically allow Goran Dragic either to opt out or you trade him after he opts in, because you want to build your team around Justice Winslow? Are you building your team around this player? Is he good enough that you feel like, okay, if he is our primary ball handler, I feel comfortable about the direction of our team? Because if he's not, then you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because I'm just not someone who thinks that he's ever going to be a top 30 player in the NBA, even a top 50 player in the NBA, because you don't see that dynamism as a leading man. Like that is a particular skill set that, to me, Dame Lillard has. That's what you want out of that player, your primary ball handler, the guy you're building around. I just don't think Justice has that. A great player who does good things. I want to say great player. A good player who does good things, but I don't think he's that kind of guy. And so if he has to be built around that way, is his ceiling as, a defensive stopper and an occasional contributor on offense? But ultimately, if you're building your team around him, your team is not very good. Which leads me to my next thing, which is the other thing that is going to emerge here after the All-Star break is, do the Miami Heat, basically after two games, have a path laid out for them? So they start tonight at Philly. That's a really difficult game for a Philly team that's going to start to figure out. I want to talk about Philly coming up next, and just in general, the NBA and the Eastern Conference, because they've added Jimmy Butler, they added Tobias Harris, and now they're a team that's going to be contending at the top of the conference. And so if, Philadelphia puts together a solid win at home over Miami, and then Saturday is kind of a massive game because the Heat are in a chase to try and get into the postseason. They're never going to tank it. They're trying to win those games, but that's certainly a game that they're well capable of losing. Frankly, the thing with the Miami is that they're kind of well capable of beating anyone, as evidenced by the fact that they give a really strong account of themselves at Golden State, and they're well capable of losing to anyone, as evidenced by the fact they lost at home to Chicago. They have both ends of the spectrum covered with what they can do. They are good enough to, on any given night, beat anybody, and they're bad enough to, on any given night, lose to anyone. That is what they are as a team, and that about leads up to a few games under 500. And so if they lose in Philly and then lose a coin flip game against Detroit, you might be a game and a half, two games out of the playoffs, and then your schedule is not really getting any easier over the final stretch of the season. And so if the Heat are now at a place, they already are, they're in the lottery odds, are the Heat at a place where they might be, not dictated, but it might just kind of lay out for them, all right, well, there's losing in front of them, and maybe they start to pack it in a little bit. I don't know what that looks like, but I think there's a real chance that they don't make the playoffs, and if they don't, that might actually end up being better for them in the long run. I've advocated this a fair amount, and then they go out and beat Dallas in the last game before the All-Star break on the road. So I mean, it's certainly possible that Miami can, you know, win a bunch of games and get into the playoffs and maybe even give a good account of themselves. But, I mean, it might be early. It might be by Sunday that you look at it and go, well, they lost to Detroit. They lost to Philly. They're six games under 500. What are we doing? What are they going? I mean, they play Phoenix on Monday. They'll win that game. But, I mean, there is this scenario in which they're five, six games under. They're starting to head towards the draft positions. And in my opinion, it's never a bad time to start looking down with this team. Again, if you had a chance to convince yourself, well, if we played this team in a playoff series, well, we want to get in because you want to get young guys. Yeah, those young guys have playoff experience. Those young guys have experience in difficult games. I mean, we saw it last year. It wasn't particularly great for a lot of them. But, I mean, we have seen this Heat team in some playoff situations with their young players, and I just don't think that's valuable enough that you really want to give up an opportunity to, I mean, hell, even get into the top four of the draft. But even beyond that, just get a player at 10 because the Heat draft well now. They're a player development team. And so there's opportunity there for them to look down and maybe see the NBA draft as an option. But, I mean, I've probably done this segment 15 times and they go out and win the next game every time. So, I mean, maybe, who knows, they win in Philly tonight and the course changes your thinking about the playoffs again. But I don't think it's really a bad time to start looking in that direction. But the organization's never going to do that. But maybe you start to think, okay, if they lose a couple of games in a row, they're six games under, they're out of the playoffs, and maybe they're the 10th, they're 10th or 11th in the lottery standings, then you start to maybe think about it. But I think tonight and Saturday goes a long way in that decision. Again, we're, you know, got a third of the season left, and so we'll see what the Heat end up doing. Coming up next, though, I want to talk about actually the Heat's opponent tonight and a few other things related to the NBA Eastern Conference. The top four is fascinating, in my opinion, plus a little bit on Zion Williamson. That's next. Chris Whittingham here until 7. We got a Florida Panthers coverage tonight. Panthers hosting the Carolina Hurricanes at BB&T Center. More on the way here on WQAM.
Radio.com. Radio.com.
I'm Wayne here on 560 WQAM here until 7 p.m. this evening. We have coverage of the Florida Panthers and the Carolina Hurricanes from BB&T Center this evening. 7 p.m. puck drop for the Panthers coming up in about 20 minutes from now. I'll be joined by Doug Plagans and Billy Lindsay, the radio voices of the Florida Panthers, talk about tonight's game and look ahead to all of the matchups and such. BB&T Center is the venue tonight. 7 p.m. puck drop. Come over to the arena and check this game out. It's going to be a fun one. Carolina with plenty to play for. Obviously, the Panthers with plenty to play for as they try and continue their push towards the postseason. But I mentioned that I wanted to talk about tonight's opponent for the Miami Heat, who are back in action tonight, the Philadelphia 76ers. And in general, the NBA Eastern Conference, so a lot of people are talking about it through the prism of who's the best of the four teams between Milwaukee, Philly, Toronto, and Boston. And who's going to, you know, get to the finals and eventually play Golden State. But as is the case with the NBA, I think from a narrative standpoint, I think it's actually who fails is more interesting to me. I think obviously the LeBron James narrative not winning a championship was something that really drove the league for a long time. And, you know, last year Houston having an opportunity and not going. I mean, you think about it. I mean, Golden State, you know, losing and nearly losing to Oklahoma City were fascinating storylines that really drove their narrative for the following year and drove the narrative for Kevin Durant to go there. I think if Golden State, you know, goes 73 wins in the regular season and, you know, wins going away in the finals, I don't think Kevin Durant is a Golden State Warrior. And so I think losing and who loses in this league does end up shaping a lot of what ends up happening. And so I think in the East, I think if you separate the four teams, I think the Bucks probably have, I would say, the least to lose. Let's say if they went out in round two, even as a one seed, I don't think anyone would go, well, Mike Budenholzer's bad, or Giannis is going to leave, or, you know, their blueprint is broken. I think, you know, they'd retool, they'd go again, they might try and add a better second star than Chris Middleton and see what they can figure out in the offseason. Maybe even, who knows, trade for Anthony Davis in the offseason. Whatever the case may be, I don't think Milwaukee has a ton to lose by going out of the Eastern Conference playoffs, and that narrative falling on top of them is not really going to be that bad. And also, it's Milwaukee. It's not, you know, quite that blue blood team that you feel like they've got the pressure on them. But for me, the other three, it's monumental what happens if they lose. So let's start first with Philly, the opponent tonight for the Miami Heat. Think about what they've done, really, not just this year, but for a period of much longer than that. The Philadelphia 76ers, as you look at, obviously, the process and the amount of losing that they did. So going back to 2013, which is when Sam Hinkie takes over, they went 19-63, 18-64, 10-72, and 28-54, so that they can be good in these 2 years. So it's basically been a six-year process so that they can either build up the assets to acquire players as they did or continue drafting or create the cap space to go in free agency. They decided to cash in all the assets they developed. They drafted and developed Robert Covington into a player. They drafted Dario Saric, waited 2 years for him to come from Europe to the United States, and they used him to get Jimmy Butler. And then you pull off an amazing trade and acquired a Heat pick, and you use that Heat pick to then go and get Tobias Harris from the Los Angeles Clippers, along with a few other players that you had on your roster as well. And so you have 6 years' worth of work into building this team that you feel like kind of has, what, 3.5 superstars? I don't know if Tobias Harris is a full-fledged superstar, but it's obviously a fantastic player. I mean, they've cashed in everything to go forward with this team, and who knows if they lose. If they keep Jimmy Butler, if they keep Tobias Harris, then you got to extend Ben Simmons. And again, Ben Simmons, Clutch Sports, LeBron James, there's a lot there that might indicate that in 3 or 4 years' time, this might be a player that no longer wants to be in Philadelphia. They're going to need to prove that they're championship caliber, and yet right now, the NBA standings are not kind to the Philadelphia 76ers. They haven't really put it together. They're fifth in the Eastern Conference, and I think a lot of people have expected them to be better even before they traded for Jimmy Butler and for Tobias Harris. So can that lineup work? Can they figure out the chemistry and the combinations that would allow that team to really unlock itself? I don't know. I mean, that starts tonight, and even so, Joel Embiid is not playing. So without Joel Embiid, can you figure, and that just reduces the number of games that you can see that group of five players figure it out. The Philadelphia 76ers have so much work to do, and they don't have a lot of time to do it. And anytime any player misses a week, 10 days, 3 or 4 games worth, I mean, you're not really practicing that much at this stage of the year. Can they really develop that chemistry? And again, if they lose in round two, which right now would require, them to get to a second-round series. They might lose in round one because right now the 4-5 is Boston-Philly, but we're kind of all presuming that Indiana is going to fall back to either the 4 or the 5, and Philly would play them and presumably beat them. But if they lose in round two, what happens to their model? Do they blow the whole thing up? Are they signing Jimmy Butler to a 5-year contract extension? Are they bringing back Tobias Harris? And what is everyone going to think of this process that will, to that point, have only produced 2 series victories in 6 years, and that's going to come down on their heads? And we're going to talk about Philly in the offseason. The kind of dirty secret of the NBA right now is that 4 of the top 5 teams are in the Eastern Conference, but then, you know, probably, you know, 11 of the next 12 are in the West. And so, I mean, you look at, I think Philly is, it might be the second best team in the Western Conference, but I look at that model and what they've built. A lot can be destroyed if they go out of the playoffs in round two. But the thing is that 2 of these 4 teams are. So Milwaukee, Philly, let's get to Toronto now. Toronto, another team that looked at their situation last year, determined it wasn't good enough. They flipped DeMar DeRozan, a player they had under contract, a player that had done a lot of winning for them, albeit not in the postseason. But, I mean, you win 59 regular season games, and you're, you know, one of the anchor tenants of it. You're really good. Like, you're really good as a NBA player if you can lead your team to 59 wins in the Eastern Conference, as DeMar DeRozan did for Toronto. But they also decided not good enough. They fired their coach. They trade for Kawhi Leonard. And now they've basically been on a years-long charm offensive to try and keep him. And then Kawhi Leonard's telling reporters at the All-Star break, it's cold in Toronto. I mean, there is no fixing that. And it could be uncomfortable if Toronto, again, if they go out in round two, you're basically guaranteeing that Kawhi Leonard's going to go. And again, where do you go from here? Are you just that nearly team that got to a conference finals, that got to round two a few times and just wasn't able to do anything, almost no matter what you did? I mean, if you're Masai Ujiri, do you go, well, what the hell do I have to do to win the championship? I mean, they've been as well-run as a team can be in terms of finding players in every nook and cranny of the NBA draft and internationally, and they find Pascal Siakam, who's going to be, you know, a top-level player in the NBA. They've done everything right. They trade for Kawhi Leonard, who's a top-10 player, and they're really good, but are they good enough, again, to get out of round two? I mean, if you go out in round two, it's just devastating for the progress. And then the last one might be the biggest of them all. It's the Boston Celtics. I mean, the Boston Celtics, I mean, you talk about a years-long process. I mean, it's basically been for Boston since they made the Kevin Garnett-Paul Pierce trade to Brooklyn, which I'm trying to find. Oh, man, I'm trying to find the date on it. 2013 is when they made that trade for the Brooklyn picks and basically getting off of Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and starting their rebuild. It's been since 2013, 6 years. How many opportunities have they had to flip Brooklyn picks to cash it in for superstars? And then after that, after you have Kyrie Irving traded in for a tremendous haul, you built up Isaiah Thomas, this guy who was kind of a throw-in in a Phoenix trade, and you built him up to a place where he's an all-star and he's an anchor tenant of a trade for a guy who's an NBA Finals caliber player in Kyrie Irving. You are able to convince with cap space Gordon Hayward to come to your team, another top 30 caliber player who has this enormous level of skill that unfortunately is literally broken within a quarter of you actually putting the thing together. You nail two draft picks in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. You have secondary draft picks that have worked, like Terry Rozier. You bring in Marcus Morris, and you put together a really solid team, but you could still make that last move. That last move is on for them. If they keep their team together and trade for Anthony Davis, they can become a perennial NBA Finals contender, and if Kevin Durant leaves Golden State, you become the Finals contender if you trade for Anthony Davis with the team that you have without giving up too much of it. And yet, if they lose in round two, Kyrie Irving might be the next to go, because Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving look like buddies at All-Star Weekend, and that might be the combination. If the New York Knicks traded away Kristaps Porzingis so they can create a second max slot to accommodate Kevin Durant and another player, that other player might be Kyrie Irving. And to me, the only way that you basically guarantee and lock in that Kyrie Irving's going to be that guy is if you make the finals and put in a good shift against Golden State, make it a 5 or 6-game series that's competitive. I mean, 5 games in a blowout, I mean, you're down 3-0, you sneak a game and then you win game 5. That's one thing. But if you're competitive against Golden State, then Kyrie Irving's probably not going to want to go to the New York Knicks. Again, losing and who loses and when they lose determines so much of basketball that I'm really fascinated by how those four teams get on. I think Milwaukee, their franchise doesn't really change that much. They've got a bunch of expiring contracts. They have a bunch of cap space. But, I mean, even if they made the finals, you're really attracting a lot of top talent to Milwaukee. It sounds condescending, and if they heard this in Milwaukee, they'd be like, really? Like, what do we have to do? We've built a great organization. We have one of the top 5 players in the league who might win the MVP this year. What do we have to do to become a free agent destination? But it's just a matter of location, and I don't know if Milwaukee is going to be that place for NBA players to want to go. And so I don't know how much of their franchise and what their model and what they've built is really that dependent on how much they win this year, but no doubt for those other three teams. And it starts tonight for Philadelphia, I should say, against the Miami Heat. And I think all those teams are going to cruise to a first-round series victory. But once you get beyond that, I don't know how much is available for those four teams to really lose. I mean, you can't lose in round two and not have major ramifications and not have almost some pretty devastating results as a product of not being able to win. I think you're going to see players leave those teams, and you're going to see some organizations that really don't know where to turn after that, especially when this is the year that kind of everyone in the East was waiting for. The first sans LeBron James. LeBron James is no longer dominating the conference, and now these teams view that opportunity as here. They don't want it to last 1 year. You've built an infrastructure and an organization and a plan that is meant to withstand the departure of LeBron James and now is now capable of building into a champion. Can any of these teams do it? They kind of need a second year and Kevin Durant to leave Golden State, but I don't know if they're going to be afforded that opportunity if they lose early enough. So, again, top of the East, fascinating to me. But coming up next, we're going to talk about an Eastern Conference, but in the National Hockey League, Doug Plagans will join me for some crosstalk ahead of the Florida Panthers and the Carolina Hurricanes. We're live from the BB&T Center this evening as we build up to the Panthers and the Hurricanes. That's next here on WQAM.
Radio.com. Radio.com.
Panthers, as they enter tonight's game, the last of their very lengthy homestand, as we bring in now Doug Plagans and Billy Lindsay. Obviously, the homestand has been profitable from a winning standpoint. They've won their last couple of games, but this is the end. Do you think that the Panthers have done enough here in this run of games?
Panthers have won 9 of the last 13 games, and that's it's been a good run. And, of course, doing it against a lot of teams that are that have playoff aspirations. So the Panthers have been playing a really good brand of hockey. They've won 3 straight coming into this one. Do still have that game against L.A. coming up here at the BB&T Center on Saturday, and then it's going to be off to the road again for the Panthers after that. A pretty road-heavy month of March is up ahead, but Panthers been playing a really good brand of hockey here as of late, and again, having won 3 in a row, still very much in this mix here, and there's about a quarter of the regular season still to play here, so certainly time for the Panthers to be able to continue this run and make that push into one of those wild card spots in the Eastern Conference.
And it's getting done with their star players. Barkov and Huberto have been scintillating the last couple of games. They've been able to score some goals that have been out of this world, so they've got all kinds of confidence in leading the charge, and they're starting to get better at even strength. And in the third period, last 2 games, outscoring the opponent at 5-on-5 hockey, 9-4 in the 3-game winning streak, 11-6, and it's happened at a time where the power play has gone relatively dry. So it's good to see this production going 5-on-5. That's where you really need it in the work. And there's a more balanced attack. They're spreading out their ice time. We saw Hauerluck get bumped up last game with Trocheck and Dadonov. He provided a goal in the third period. That was a big spark. He played with a ton of energy. But up and down, you got people that you can trust in the lineup. The penalty kill has been exceptional. So this team's rolling good. James Reimer in net has been solid. He's been a brick wall. He's been providing the goaltending that you need. See what it happens. Take it one game at a time.
Forgive me, I sure changed the Panthers. One more home game before they play Saturday against the Los Angeles Kings. Then 3 on the road against Colorado, Arizona, and Las Vegas. Let's take a look at the performance on Tuesday night against Buffalo. And for me, I think Alexander Barkov following up a hat trick with 3 more points. This is around the time that you want to see him not just play well, which he does every night, but really start to dominate games and get in the goals.
Well, that's exactly what he did these last couple of games, is he has just been dominant, and his whole line was dominant the other night against Buffalo. And that was a game where the Panthers, you could tell they've really been a confident bunch here over this stretch of games. They've won 9-13, as I mentioned, but in that game against Buffalo, they were down 1-0. But you never saw any sort of panic from them. And in the third period, they just totally took over and ended up winning that game 4-2, 4 third period goals. So you saw that the Panthers really sticking to the game plan all night long, and that paid off for them in the third period. And that's really a product, I think, of this team just showing the confidence that they've built up here on this stretch, knowing that if they just stick with what's been working, that it's going to pay off in their favor, and that's what happened in the third period.
And Barkov skating better. There's a lot more movement. There's much more jump in his step, and what you can see that since Trocheck's come back, the numbers come down around 23, 24 minutes a night to around 21.5, and that's a 2.5-minute difference. But what happens when a guy's playing all that time? You have to cut corners in the third period. I really notice it in his skating. You can see that first step is there, and there's some jump, and there's some pop in the legs, which you're looking for, and that's been what this team has been all about. And because you can roll those 4 lines, Barkov is effective around that 21-minute mark. He can dominate the opposition. 5-on-5, they've been much better, and that's why this team has started to turn the corner, because their star players are playing better. You got a more balanced attack throughout, and everyone seems to be contributing in some factor.
I want you to go a bit further on that difference, because that doesn't strike me as being that big of 2.5 minutes, but What is 2.5 minutes in a hockey game, and what does it mean to a player to play just that little bit less so that when you're on the ice, it can be a bit more in terms of giving 100% of your energy that you have left?
Well, if you go around the top teams in the league, if you take a look at the Boston Bruins, you take a look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, you look at the Nashville Predators, And you go to these teams, all their top players are around 19 and a half, 20 minutes. They don't play more than that. And once you get up over that 20-minute mark, you're starting to push it. Barkov can go over 20. 24 is too much. It doesn't seem like a lot, but those 3 minutes, yeah, that's a lot. And if you're out there for that amount of time, you're going to have to be out there and cut some corners defensively and take some
what
stuff.
What does that mean, cutting corners?
Cutting corners, not playing at full speed all the time. You just can't go out there. Some shifts you're not going to have it because you're out there every second shift. You're going to be a little bit tired. So maybe not give the full effort on the defensive end or the offensive end. He's one of the best two-way players. But when you cut it down those couple of minutes, he won't cheat the game anymore. And that's what happens with one of the best two-way guys. He can play full throttle at one end and go down the other end with the same way. And you're right, it doesn't seem like much, 2.5 minutes in a hockey game. But when you're doing it game after game after game, that's a lot of ice time that you're starting to cut down and save on a player. And Barkov is one of those players. He can play 24, 25 minutes. He is just more effective at the number that he is now.
And that's what you see. Alexander Barkov, I believe, second in the league now in terms of forward minutes played. So even though the ice times come down a little bit, which is certainly by design, and getting Vincent Trocheck back in the lineup has given the Panthers that much more flexibility and allowed them to kind of slot everybody back in at the ice time levels and where in the lineup they're supposed to fit. Connor McDavid, the only forward in the league that plays more minutes than Alexander Barkov. So again, even though that time's come down, he's still just the ultimate workhorse and still shouldering such a heavy load for this Panthers team.
He is. He does everything. But and you look, you got to have those second, third, and fourth lines to contribute a little bit. How's it working out in Edmonton with Connor McDavid playing 25 minutes a night and he's the only go-to guy? That's how it was here in Florida for a while. Tampa Bay, the best team in the NHL, their third and fourth lines, they won the other night. Kucherov didn't have a point. And they had Braden Point was out of the lineup. They had their two-star players didn't really contribute. So that's where it's really separated with the top teams and the best. And the Panthers now are like that. They're better than the opposition. They're deeper than a lot of hockey clubs. And this is the way the team was designed and hopefully set up at the start of the season. Bringing in a couple of veterans like Sheahan and Brassard that have a ton of playoff experience. They've been able to bounce it around, play extremely well. And Bob Bugner has trust in those guys. But it's a different looking lineup and it's a different team, much different than we saw in the first half of the season.
I wanted to ask you, so the NHL trade deadline is not far away. It's February the 25th. Would you expect any movement from the Panthers? They've already made a couple of trades. Would you expect anything?
Well, I think, it's just a wait-and-see kind of thing.
I think it's wide open. I think Dale, the phone is there. He's going to listen to everything, every possibility. So would I expect something? Maybe. Maybe not. But there are going to be offers coming. From both sides, Dale's going to reach out to people, and people are going to reach out to Dale. And if there's a deal that makes sense, I 100% think that they're not afraid to pull the trigger.
Sure.
Mr. Viola's going to spend, and he's going to do what's right. And if he gets a deal and Dale says, hey, this is going to be right for our hockey team, they'll do it because they want to win.
And the one thing you hear from Dale Tallon all the time, doesn't matter what part of the year it is, you always hear his willingness. He's always looking to, you know, for the long-term betterment of, you know, if he can do something that's going to improve the team in the long run, he's always willing to entertain and listen to things. So
All right, so I wanted to now focus in on this playoff chase. So the Panthers 9 points out, but with a game in hand on Columbus. Carolina, another team that's above them in the standings, already beat Buffalo earlier this week. And they've faced a slew of these teams and have done pretty well, all things considered, both home and away. But comparing the East and the West, that standard for the Panthers, it's 2 years in a row now where I almost feel bad for them that they were better last year, certainly, particularly down that home stretch. But the standard that it takes in order to make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference, it's just at a really high level right now. There's so many good teams that it's just hard for the Panthers, who aren't a bad team by any means. They're good enough to be a playoff-caliber team, but it's just so damn hard in this conference.
Well, I mean, there's still a quarter of the season left. The Panthers are still making a push and could still find themselves in one of those playoff spots in the Eastern Conference. Looking at the West, that's just the way things have shaken out this year. The bar looks like it could be a little bit lower in the Western Conference as far as that point threshold to get in.
A little bit. It's going to be about 10 points lower. The West is there's some bad teams in the West, and they're getting beat up upon by those top teams. But you look at it. And this is one of those games tonight, Chris, against Carolina. You're trying to chase them. This is the biggest game of the year. This is really? Of all these games on this homestand, if you're trying to chase down teams and you give them those extra 2 points, yep, those are tough to make up. So this, you look at it, this is the most important game of the year. Great winning streak, everything that's going on, but this is one that you absolutely have to have against Carolina. You lose some of these types of games that you're head-to-head with. We call them four-point games.
Yeah.
But this is one of those four-point games that the Panthers have to have go their way.
They got a four-pointer this evening. But, I mean, would even a shootout or overtime victory, I mean, you still give them that point.
That hurts. This A three-point game would hurt tonight. You want this one in regulation.
Yeah, no doubt. And in terms of the matchup with Carolina this evening, what do you make of how these two teams counteract in terms of styles, and who do you think has the better of the matchup?
Well, you look at Carolina right now, and they're a team that puts as many pucks to the net as they possibly can. And you know, you have to expect that. They're going to shoot, and they're going to shoot from everywhere. The other thing with Carolina right now, a little bit different look. These two teams haven't seen each other since much earlier in the season. And Carolina, even though they've got a really good record, 15-6-1 since the turn of the new year, they're on a good little run. They're without not necessarily their biggest point producer, but in my opinion, maybe their most important player, Jordan Staal. I mean, he's their shutdown two-way centerman that they match up against guys like Alexander Barkov when they take on teams that have a guy like an Alexander Barkov. He's the big centerman that they match up with those guys. They don't have him, but it hasn't really affected them too much lately. They've been able to win games without him.
You touched on the shots per game, and Carolina wasn't winning earlier. As a team, they had a 6.2 shooting percentage. Last 23 games, they've gone 16-6-1. That shooting percentage has gone up to 11.2. They're starting to score on their chances, and they're getting better defensively. You look at the last eight games, only 12 goals against. In those eight games, three shutouts, two of them by the goaltender Mrazek. And their goaltender numbers are off the charts the last six. Their goals against average combined with McElhinney and Mrazek, just over one, in their save percentage, 960. So they're scoring on their chances. The goaltending is getting it done down at the other end. This is a confident group,
And
we'll see what happens. They did lose their last game to the Rangers, but that wasn't for lack of trying, as they just peppered them with shots. They outshot the Rangers 44-26. It just happened to be Lundqvist was a little bit better down at the other end.
And when Rod Brind'Amour talked before the game, I asked him just what's been, and we'll hear from him when we get to the network broadcast here shortly, but I asked him just when Carolina's playing well, what the biggest key to their success is, and he said it's just, you know, everybody's playing pretty good, and he said they're getting, when they get contributions up and down the lineup, things go in their favor, and he also said it's just funny how it works out sometimes, because the game they lost against the Rangers last time out might have been the best game they played in the last little bit, but they weren't able to score. It just didn't work out in their favor, so it's just funny how that works.
Yes or no answer quickly. We got 15 seconds. Is the Barkov goal against Montreal the best goal you've seen in person?
Best goal I've seen in person. I've called over 800 games in pro games. It's the best goal I've seen in person.
Bill Lindsay.
My memory doesn't go back very far. I'd have to dig deep. So, yes, it's the best goal I've seen in person. Definitely the goal of the year in the NHL. He almost, even the last goal that he scored last game, it wasn't far behind it where he picked it up with that pass. The individual skill that he has is through the roof. It's just mind-blowing.
Florida Panthers and Carolina Hurricanes coming up next year on 560 WQAM.
Radio.com. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.